Good morning. Just like to thank Stephen for agreeing to come and visit us today, take time off from his busy schedule of fishing around the country. So that was very nice, and we'd like to thank Stephen for coming today, and I'm sure this will be a fantastic learning and networking experience for us all. And as for those of you that don't know, Stephen Darrells will be providing us with a daily inspiration for networking 2004, and I'm sure you've all registered by now. I'll be handing out brochures later. So that'd be great. So we're all looking forward to that. So I'll just hand it over to Stephen, so take it away. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. We begin the talk with a commercial message. So you know right off the bat, those squiggling lines are me recording the talk. I've been recording all of the talks that I've done throughout Australia. I've lost count, 16, 17 talks as I've gone across the country, up and down and all over. And it was all in preparation, for a talk I did Saturday. The days are merging together for me. At the Australian College of Educators Conference. So this is sort of like the thing after the big talk that I've been building up to. So this is the letdown. I'm just kidding. You're supposed to laugh at that. I'm going to begin. I don't know who you are and where you've come from. Australia, obviously. But I just want to find out who you are very briefly so I know who I'm talking to, because right now I'm just sort of talking to faces, which is useful but doesn't tell me a lot about background and things like that. So maybe if I can just zip through. I don't want to linger too long on this. We have a limited amount of time. I've got lots of stuff I'd like to cover both today and tomorrow. So I want to start with that. Yeah, let's do that first, and then we'll move on into the talk. If I appear a little bit frazzled, I am. I thought I was going to be in Fremantle this morning. And yesterday I went down to Fremantle to scope it all out and to find out, where the talk was and all of that. And so those are the pictures I took while I was in Fremantle yesterday. Obviously, neither of those resembles a meeting room or much less this building, which, of course, as you know, is not the Fremantle. So, and then I thought the seminar started at 9, and so I'm in the cab, not going to Fremantle, but going to Leaderville, trying to convince the cab, turn in here, turn in here, turn in here. I know it's here. I know there's no signs, but turn in here. And he dropped me off at the TAFE. And then there were nothing but like fences and walls and gates and locks. So anyhow, I thought I was here like 15 minutes late. So I'm still frazzled from being late, even though I got here early and we're all set up and we're on time. So that's my mental state. It's actually not nearly as unusual as it may seem. So we'll zip through and find out who you are. Tell me who you are, where you're from, and why you're here. And in a couple of sentences. I don't want to spend the entire session doing this. I know it's a great time filler, but I've got too much content to fill time. So.
I'm a TAFE lecturer, and I'm interested in the practice side of the community and
Well, yeah, we could talk about intellectual property and copyright. Is that one of the topics that I cover? I know today, so I don't know tomorrow's. No?
But we can diverge.
We'll diverge. I have many, many comments on copyright.
Hi, and I'm just from Western Services,
contact coordinator there. I'm George. I'm the Quality Assurance Coordinator for Western Services, and I'm very interested in what you're
saying. Am I doing quality tomorrow? We'll diverge.
I'm Alistair Catherine. I'm the coordinator of the Learning Balance Funders at TAFE. I'm sort of basically generally interested in different types of learning things.
I'm Julie Kennedy. I'm the instructional designer at Australia.
I'm Paula O'Brien. I'm instructional designer at Australia.
I'm Naomi Cheever. I'm a teacher currently working at Learning Balance Funders.
Okay. Everyone's interested. That's good.
Karen Duncan, I'm a project manager of K-12 curriculum resources. And yeah, I heard some good raps about you, so I came on to check it out.
So far, you've been sorely disappointed.
Not yet.
Not yet. We'll give it time.
Jessica, from one of the innovative youth advisors at Westland, I'm a community
for those of you listening on the tape, they are talking, they're just talking quietly. Which way will they start?
I'm following the children. That comes from Future Max. And I'll be working with one of the ones that you will be managing to suggest that they do this one. This workshop will be very useful.
Stephen Beach from Wesley College of France, who lived long-time readers, old lady. Yeah, responsible for implementing technology.
I'm Kit Choppy, writer of French materials for middle school at Westland. I'm interested in the pedagogy and the building of community in particular. The use of pedagogy for pedagogy. George Houston, I'm a writer for the new career and head start here at the school course that's come out. And I'm basically interested in learning more about online learning.
Okay, so most of you are from West One. You're kind of clustered over there. And you've got some TAFE and some private school, I guess. It's an interesting mix, and what I'm doing is just rewriting the talk right now. No, I'm just kidding. Okay, what you were promised today, you notice how I phrased that, is a talk on knowledge and learning, then a talk on social networking, then a talk on community and practices, community of practices. I'm going to mix it up a little bit, but not a lot. You're still going to get those three things today. But I'm going to spend a little more time on knowledge and learning, a little less time on social networking, although we will tour some social networking sites, assuming I get internet access here, just for fun, because I like going in and making fun of them, and then talk about communities of practice. Although I will caution, I discovered two things at about the same time this morning. The first thing was that it was 20 to 9, and that's when I looked up from what I was doing, and oh my, I'm late. And the second thing I discovered at exactly the same time is that my community of practice slides have become gibbled in the way that Microsoft gibbles things. But that's okay. I mean, I'm not too worried about that because the slides are just innate anyways. But I'm going to take a little time during the break to ungibble them. So what I'm going to do, besides that, and the reason why it was like 20 to 9 when I looked up is that there's some good stuff that I really want to cover and I think will be important, especially for those of you who are working in pedagogy and instructional design and of general interest to the rest of you on the knowledge and learning part. Because from where I stand, it's the knowledge and learning part that sets up the rest. And so we need to have, well, I won't say some kind of common understanding, but at least a common vocabulary and a common framework for the knowledge and learning that tells you a bit where I'm coming from, and then the rest of the pieces will fall into place. So let me first check and see if that meets with your approval. If not? Okay, and now having said that, and the funny thing is, because my background is as a philosopher, that's what my formal training is, so you'd think knowledge and learning, I'm right there, but in all the talks that I've done over the years, I haven't actually been asked to do talks on philosophy, which for me strikes me as very odd and bizarre, but not surprising. So I haven't actually given the knowledge and learning talk at all. So it might be a bit chunky in places, but on the other hand, you're not getting repeat content. So you're getting brand new content that I've never tried before, which is always what I try to do anyways, but usually I stay closer to the themes. So all of those prelims and qualifiers aside, oh, one more prelim. This talk is for you. This is, I'm assuming somebody paid for this somewhere. None of the money made it to me, but that's okay. But this talk is for you. This is your time. You're taking time out of your life and your work to be here, which means that the direction of the talk and the content of the talk needs to be guided by you. The opinions, of course, will all be mine. But what opinions you get to pick from. And at any point during the talk, if you want to ask a question, make a comment, interject, call me names, say, no, you're wrong, whatever, go for it. I mean, the dialogue's what's important. Otherwise, I could just sit at home in my home in Moncton and do a video, or I've got lots of tapes of other talks I could play, including a real good community of practice one that went really well on Saskatoon. But that's not the point, right? So the point is for us to be interacting and going back and forth as things come to your mind. So do not feel that you're interrupting me at all. Your interruptions are the reason why I'm here. So, and if you do make comment, speak loudly, because again, you're being recorded. So, and if you don't want me to record your comment, just tell me and I'll pause it. That's not a problem either. I mean, you don't have to have your words broadcast to the world. But it'd be cool if you did. And that goes back to our thing about copyright. No, I'm just kidding. Although I'm sure we'll get to that topic at some point. So, let me kill the images here. Bye-bye, Birdie. Save changes. Yeah, sure, why not? I don't know what I did, but I saved it. It must be this one. You can tell it was 20 to 9. I didn't do a title page. That's okay. This is still great content. I was getting it, and this is just it. You know, it's one of these things where you sort of get more and more and more engaged in what you're doing as you're doing it. All right. I finally get to do a talk as a philosopher where I begin with the question, what is knowledge? And I've put up a few questions here because I want to just raise right off the bat our intuitions about knowledge and so on. Because the talk itself begins with an assumption, doesn't it? The title of the talk, I didn't choose the titles of these talks, so I always like to start my talks by criticizing the title. Is that knowledge is something that we learn. We have to ask ourselves, is that the case? The assumption is that knowledge is something that we have or that we acquire. You know, we go out and get knowledge. There's knowledge management. We shift things around, so on and so forth. But one of the things I want you to consider as I go through this talk is that knowledge might not actually be a thing at all. It might not be something that's transferable at all. It might be more along the lines of a state of being. It might be like I know something in the same sense that I have gray hair. Do I have gray hair? It changes depending on the day. It might be a quality, like the color of my eyes. I mean, we go into these things assuming that we've got a pretty good handle on the concept, but I think if we push it even slightly, we find we don't have a good handle on the concept. If I ask you, why do you believe knowledge is a thing rather than a quality, what's your answer going to be? How are you going to justify it? Well, yeah, no, of course it's like a thing. It's like data, right? Well, no. Is knowledge even something that we can pass on? I mean, the whole presumption, a number of you are in instructional design, the whole presumption is the instructor or maybe the book or maybe the video has knowledge and we're passing it on to the student. Then we'll test the student to see if it actually stuck. They're like little bits of Legos, like glue in the head or something like that. And we'll try to tap the head and see if anything falls out. We'll call that knowledge. But that picture doesn't really hold to scrutiny either. That does not withstand critical investigation. So let's back off a little bit on what is knowledge, and we'll come back to that. Of course, we'll come back to that. I got to be careful not to wander. I want this thing to stay on. This tape thing, this recording thing, is an experiment for me, and I should be used to it by now. But it makes things different for me because normally I like to wander, and you know, like I've actually lectured from outside the room. I like throwing people's perceptions off. Everybody assumes that the person giving the talk should actually be in the rooms. You know. But now with this microphone here, I can't go too far from it. So I could carry it around like this, but then I'm really chained down. I need a wireless microphone. Anyhow, now I've put loud rattling sounds on. Anyhow, how do we know? I'll make a confession right off the bat, just so that you know. I am what is called an empiricist. What that means is that I believe that all knowledge is derived from experience. The contrast to that view, as we'll look at a little bit later in the talk, is the idea that knowledge is either built in or innate, that we're born with knowledge, or that we can reason or think our way through it. That we don't really need experience, we just thought about it for a while, we'd actually come to have knowledge. I don't think either of those things are true. I think that experience lies at the foundation of knowledge. But there is rationalism. Rationalism is a very important philosophy, instantiated by people like Descartes and Kant and others. People do think we can, you know, Descartes, I think, therefore I am, right? Now, how does he know we exist? Well, he makes a simple observation that he thinks, and he doesn't even experience his own thinking. He just asks himself a question. Well, am I thinking? How could I not be thinking? If I ask myself the question that I'm thinking, it follows deductively that I therefore must be thinking, and therefore I exist. You know, a little bit of something out of nothing, right? Magic. Rationalist magic. And then, I mentioned this, there's a whole pile of theories that have followed from that, but I mentioned this one specifically because this is the paradigm that most of our leaders and administrators still live in, is the paradigm of logical positivism. Logical positivism is a fascinating theory, and it held sway from the beginning of the century through all the way, well, up until the 1960s or so. Even later, depending on how you count the decline of it. Positivism is the idea that experience comes from observation. And in our mind, we make up sentences called observation sentences that describe this experience. And then on the basis of these sentences, through a process of rational deduction, we come up with all the rest of our experience. There's a very famous theory. People like, there's a whole group of philosophers known as the Vienna Circle, who promoted it, people like Moritz Schlick, for example. A.J. Ayer, A-Y-E-R, is probably the most famous of the logical positivists. And really, it persists all the way, probably up until Kuhn, with his book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which really kind of put an end to positivism. But people still, out there in the world, still think that way. They still think that that's what knowledge is, that's how we come up with knowledge. Philosophical theories die hard. I have a lot of sympathy with positivism, though. I am, after all, an empiricist. So, and my formal education was steeped in the school of positivism. Getting back to knowledge. Here's the traditional definition of knowledge. And you see the definition, I mean, it goes back to the ancient Greeks. Knowledge as justified true belief. And this definition introduces, and you can see why the positivists liked it so much, introduces the idea of evidence, right? Justification. There is some sort of inferential process that we make, and it's that process that guarantees that what we know is true. But also, the word true there is really important. It's not enough simply that we have inferred correctly to whatever conclusion we've inferred to. It's also important that what counts as knowledge be true. And by true, of course, when you start messing around with the word truth, we can get into all kinds of philosophical circles. But the definition of truth that most people are really thinking of when they think of justified true belief is something along Tarski's theory of truth. And the famous T-A-R-S-K-I. And the famous definition is the proposition snow is white is true, if and only if snow is white. You know, you can understand why that left people like me kind of scratching my head. Even more importantly, this definition brings forward the idea that knowledge is something that is based on human mental states. And this is the thing that I really tweak to. Because, first of all, if it's something that is based on a mental state, it's not just something that's out there to be picked, like apples or pears or whatever grows here. I don't know what grows here. I've seen lots of flowers, but no fruit. No, that's not true. I saw one lemon tree. One poor, miserable little lemon tree. You have bananas, okay. And they do grow on trees, don't they? Yes, they grow in great big bunches. I would, you know. Right. But the other thing is, if it is based on a mental state, then there's a certain important sense that what we consider knowledge is in some way contingent, in some way possibly not true, in some way at some point uncertain, and then later on it became certain. And to me, that raises all kinds of interesting possibilities. Now, the concept of justified true belief lasted about 10 minutes in philosophy, as these things do, because somebody comes up with the definition, yes, I have defined the world, and it takes about 10 minutes for a philosopher to come up with an exception. And in this case, Edmund Gettier came up with the exception with a set of problems he calls Gettier problems. And the idea of a Gettier problem is you can have a justified true belief and still not know. Consider, for example, a person applying for a job. And Fred's applying for a job, and Joe's applying for a job. And Fred goes in and blows the interview. Just, you know, it's terrible, right? He insults the people. You know, his fly was down for the whole interview. Check. Right, so and he knows as well that Joe, just before Joe went in, he didn't have any money, so he asked Fred for some money. Fred reached into his hand, looked, oh, okay, here's 10 coins, and gave Joe 10 coins. So Joe put the 10 coins in his pocket, went in, does his interview, comes out, yeah, I got it, I aced it. So Fred is convinced that Joe's got the job. So Fred comes to the conclusion that the person who got the job has 10 coins in his pocket. Now, as it turns out, there's always a catch to these stories, right? As it turns out, Joe didn't get the job. He wasn't qualified, say. As it turns out, Fred got the job. Also, as it turns out, when Fred reached down into his pocket to give Joe some coins, he gave Joe 10 coins. He had 10 coins left in his pocket. So, unknown to him, Fred got the job. Fred had 10 coins in his pocket. Therefore, it was true that the person who got the job had 10 coins in his pocket. So now we have a case of justified true belief, which is not knowledge. Because Fred was certainly justified in believing that the person who had got the job had 10 coins in the pocket. It was true, and there's no question that it was a belief, but it wasn't knowledge. Everything fits into place, but it's not knowledge. That's your typical knot, the typical kind of knot that philosophers tie themselves into. You have this beautiful definition, somebody like Gettier comes along and shoots it full of holes. Because of that, there came the idea that there needs to be what they called a fourth condition to knowledge, right? Justified, true belief, and what? And the idea, and the problem with the case that I just cited is that there was no real connection between what Fred knew and what the state of the affairs of the world was. It was true, but it was only accidentally true. And the idea of knowledge is that even if it's true, there needs to be some relation between the truth of the thing and the thought that Fred had that made it true. So there was the search for the fourth clause. And I've just listed three things here. There's actually a whole slew of them, but they all kind of fit the same pattern, right? One was that knowledge is actually caused by the state of the world, right? Fred's knowledge that the person who got the job had 10 coins was not in any way relevantly caused by that fact out there in the world. You couldn't draw a causal chain between them. Of course, the problem with that is you can't draw causal chains between anything, really. So, you know, anyhow, loads of debate. There's another idea that the knowledge should cohere with an overall web of belief, as Quine calls it, or a worldview, as other people call it. So if it fits into his overall pattern of knowledge, that's what fixes it. But that doesn't really address the Quine problem either, does it? I mean, it's not like Fred has violated his sense of the world view when he said that the person who got the job had 10 coins in his pocket. Fit perfectly. So, I mean, world views can still lead us to believe the right thing, but by accident. Suppose you had a mental image, or sorry, a mental condition, and you believe that they were out to get you. And your entire world view is based on this. Of course, we've heard lots of stories like that. There's a movie with Mel Gibson in it. I had to throw in an Australian reference. What was it called? Conspiracy Theory? Right. So, you know, a little off there. Obviously, he's making it up, right? But it's a consistent world view. And it turns out, as the old slogan goes, they are out to get you. It's true, but by accident, even though it corresponds with a world view. Or there's the idea that knowledge could be socially justified. And that's the direction that philosophy has taken, the turn that philosophy has taken. And there's some good reasons for that. And that's why when we talk about knowledge and learning, we're so interested in things like communities of practice, because there's the idea that knowledge is something that is knowledge based on not simply your internal beliefs, but the coherence of your beliefs with that of the community or the community of practice that you belong to. It's in another slide, but I'll save it for the other slide. It might even be in this one. No, it isn't. Anyhow, that one fails too. The community, the socially justified theory fails. And when it has failed in human history, it has failed spectacularly. The idea that the mob, if you will, makes something right, makes something true, is an idea that I think our history has discredited. We can look at numerous examples of societies where every member or the vast majority of members of society believed something to be true, and yet, importantly, in certain fundamental senses, it wasn't true. And a lot of wars have been caused by that, including a big one in the middle of the century. Notice how I'm dancing around without saying the words, because I don't want to evoke Godwin's Law at this point. If you're curious, Godwin's Law, G-O-D-W-I-N apostrophe S, Law. You look it up on the internet. I like leaving little tidbits like that so that you go and actually do something after the talk, because otherwise then you wouldn't do anything after the talk. Go ahead.
The world is flat.
That's a great one. The world is flat. Thank you. Everyone believed the world was flat. It was true. Had to be. Turned out to be false. The history of skepticism being the philosophy that asserts that we cannot know that we know, that we cannot know that what we know is true. The history of skepticism is, as I say, ironically, one of unending success. The skeptics are right. We can't know. Descartes with his skepticism of the senses, right? How do I know that the evidence of the senses is telling me the truth? Well, it turns out you can't. Put a stick in the water, it appears bent. Is the stick really bent? No, our senses are fooling us. Hold up your thumb and cover the sun. Is the sun the size of your thumbnail? Of course not. The senses are fooling us. David Hume was famous for his skeptical arguments. Skepticism about causality. How do you know that if you hit the one billiard ball into the other billiard ball, that the other billiard ball will move? And the answer is, we don't. All kinds of things could happen with, you know, all things considered, equal probability. The other billiard ball could just sit there. Maybe it's glued to the table. It could shatter into a million pieces. It could float up into the air and say, hi there, and then take off because it was an alien. Right? All of these things, on analysis, are equally probable because this time that you shoot the billiard ball has no logical relation to the previous time you shot the billiard ball. We think it does, but they are two separate instances. There's nothing connecting the two instances. There's no causal chain. There's no inferential chain. They're two separate things. How do we know that the past will be, or sorry, how do we know that the future will be like the past? Well, turn it, it's a wild guess. We assume that the future will be like the past, but we have no good grounds for saying this. How do we know that the floor will continue to support us? We don't. We're taking on faith. Big hole could open up at any moment and swallow us. It happens in cartoons all the time. This is the state in which I live my life, by the way. Genuinely not knowing that the floor will hold me up, that the billiard ball will move, so on and so forth. Knowledge, the thing about knowledge is, at a certain point, we have to, as they say, take a leap of faith. And that's the famous slogan from Kierkegaard, of course, and he's using it to justify adopting a religious life. But the problem with the leap of faith is, it's not like you're standing at a cliff and there's only one way to go. It's like you're standing on a point and you can go any which way. Which way do you go? Do you go forward? Do you leap backwards? Maybe this is net. Maybe there isn't. If you make the wrong choice, it could be horrible. But you don't know which, even when you're making a leap of faith. I decided to make a leap of faith into agnosticism. That was a joke. The thing about knowledge is, it's always a case, always, of getting something from nothing. Which really ought to bother the people who are commercially minded here. You say there's no such thing as a free lunch. Knowledge is a free lunch. Knowledge is something we got from nothing. It doesn't come from anywhere. It's like we've pulled it out of the air for free. Everything reduces to economics these days. All right. Now let's mess with this a little more. We're back to what we think knowledge is. And this is probably something you've seen. Those of you who've worked in the area of knowledge management have seen this. There's actually a company named after the concept. which was bought by IBM, called tacit knowledge. The idea is the distinction between, I'm hoping they're going to work rather than making an editorial comment. The distinction between knowing how to ride a bicycle and, well, knowing how cognitively and knowing how in terms of skills and practice. And you probably, most of you who are in this field have heard about this story already, right? You could explain to somebody the complete details of how to ride a bicycle, how to move their legs, how to balance, how to work the handlebar, and you turn into your fall, which really makes no sense when you think about it. I don't want to go in the direction that I'm falling. I want to go the other way. But that's how you do a bicycle, right? And you could know all of this cognitively, and still, when you get on a bicycle, the first thing you do is fall over because you don't have the skill. On the other hand, you can know completely, expertly even. I was downtown yesterday watching the kids with their bicycles and their, the half pipes and all of that. And they know how to ride these bicycles expertly. But if you ask them the theory about it, they're 5 years old, maybe not 5 years old, but 10 years old. I mean, they probably don't know about, aerodynamics and friction and stuff like that. They can know completely how to ride a bicycle without knowing any of the why. So Polanyi jumped on this. He said, there are two important different types of knowledge, knowing that and knowing how. And is the knowing how, the skills-based knowledge, or is what he called it and what knowledge management has really seized on, the tacit knowledge, is, in Polanyi's words, ineffable. It's not that it's simply not expressed. It's that it's not even expressible. We cannot actually say how it is that we ride a bicycle. We cannot actually put into words those skills that we use. Certainly the people who have those skills, some of them could not do so. Which, just as an aside, raises the question of just what it is that knowledge management is doing when they are, quote, capturing, unquote, tacit knowledge. Now, if you go out there and you look at the knowledge management sites, that's what they all claim to be doing, right? We're going to capture tacit knowledge. The company, Tacit Knowledge, which was, as I say, bought by IBM, had this great plan. What they were going to do is get, as people send email, they're to scan all the email in the company and data mine all the email in the company and create a knowledge base out of that. And that was, as they say, capturing tacit knowledge. Well, they certainly capture a pile of email. But it's not clear to me, and in fact probably not the case, that what they are capturing when they do that is capturing tacit knowledge. Because the tacit knowledge that is contained in the body of knowledge and skills held by middle managers that are about to retire is exactly what's not in the email. Knowing when to fire someone, knowing when to motivate them. These are the things that aren't put in email. They're more like riding the bicycle. It's a real problem. If you can't capture this knowledge, you can't express this knowledge, how are you going to teach this knowledge? In fact, I thought about this a little bit, and of course you can play with the concept a bit. And there are probably a whole bunch of ways of knowing, right? We have knowing that and knowing how, but there's knowing what to do. I'm standing here. Well, what do I do when I'm standing here? Presumably give a talk. What does that mean? So on and so forth. Knowing who, as in it's who you know, not what you know. Knowing why. The whole question of knowing why gets us into a big, huge muddle. If you're really interested, look up somebody called Bass C. Van Frassen. B-A-S, then C, and then Van Frassen with two A's. F-R-A-A-S-E-N. Fascinating thinker, expert in the question of why. Somebody had to be. Where and when? How do I know where I am? Well, most of today I haven't known where I was, and I certainly didn't know when I was. At the moment I was writing that phrase, I thought I was going to the wrong place, and I didn't realize I was late. Now, anyhow, we can play with that, but not only did they leave, now they want to block out the sound. Yeah. Oh, there is a clock there. Just so you know, I'm not going to go 3 hours without talking, or without stopping. We are going to take a break. We're going to take a break because I'm going to need more coffee, you're going to need more coffee, and I need to try to ungibble my community of practice slides. So I'm aiming at something like 11:15 to 11, somewhere around there. So I just thought I'd reassure you, because when I sit in talks like this, I'm always sitting there. The person at the front of the room is talking. My main thought is, when's the break? So that's why I try to get people interactive, right? It's just more fun that way. Anyhow, what is learning? Well, we already know what it isn't because of what we've talked about. The accumulating of a set of facts, the putting of Lego blocks in your head, obviously not. I don't think anybody thinks that anymore. Well, except for educational administrators and people who design like high-stakes testing. Of course it's not. I mean, we all know the stories about people who have all kinds of knowledge in their head and yet really on the face of it are as they call, idiot savants. There's the story of, who was it? It wasn't Frege, it was... incompleteness theory. Kurt Gödel, brilliant mind, brilliant mathematical mind, came up 1 year with the completeness theory that showed that logic is internally self-consistent, and then the following year, apparently without contradiction, came up with the incompleteness theory, which said that logic cannot show that it itself is true. Got a job at, I think it was MIT or something like that, and eventually starved to death because he forgot to eat. I don't know if this is true, but I read it, so it must be. Learning is doing. And we hear about that. We hear about that a lot in various educational theories, right? Practice makes perfect. If that worked, I would be an expert darts player. I mean, the thing with learning about as doing is we don't know why we're doing it. We learn the skill. It's the old Karate Kid thing, right? Wax on, wax off, wax on. And the poor kid, he waxes the car, he paints the fence. But he hasn't learned, he doesn't know until the master says, "Hoy." Well, he doesn't really say it, but, you know, and the kid goes instinctively, "Oh, I see now, I see why I did that." Right, but he doesn't know until he has the why. Even though he has the mental skills, the knowledge doesn't come until the why has been added. We have constructivism. I'm not going to give you a long talk on constructivism because I don't think there would be a point. But the main idea of constructivism is the idea that knowledge is in some way constructed by the student. So instead of a transmission mode like we're doing now, we have the development or the building mode where I have mixed feelings about constructivism because, you know, I should sort of come in. If constructivism worked purely, I could come in and say, well, what is knowledge? And then you guys would all tell me. No, I'm just kidding. I really should be able to erase from my tapes, but... Actually, my main problem with constructivism is a bit different from that, but that's the subject of the second half of this talk, so we'll get to that. I don't do linear very well. You've probably already seen that. Somebody characterized the talks that I gave in Tasmania as talks in a hypertext. So I'm going to go back to the beginning of the talk now. And we're going to approach the question from a different angle. What is knowledge? Two. We come back to the question again of where we get knowledge. And you've probably all heard of Noam Chomsky. And before Noam Chomsky became a political activist, he was reasonably well known in philosophical circles as a linguist. People forget this. And actually, if you look at Chomsky, there's a really clear line between his linguistics and his politics. Anyhow, and Chomsky looks at the phenomenon of language, and he he looks at not just the stringing together of words, but of the underlying structure, the generative grammar. And then he looks at the information that's available to a language learner and a child, and he says, there's no way. You cannot get that from what this child experiences. There's no way. Can't be done. And so his idea, he calls this the argument from the poverty of the stimulus. The stimulus are not sufficient to justify, and there's that word again, right, to justify or to produce even the knowledge that's resulted. And so he concludes that there must be an innate or inborn knowledge capacity. And we hear that a lot, even in today's cognitive psychology, the idea of a language faculty and the language region of the brain, and the idea that we're born with a linguistic ability. It's funny, it's the old saying, cats meow because cats meow. I have three cats, they don't meow. Well, one of them meows, but it's just a... My thinking about this, my own theory about this, that cats, even though cats meow, my cats don't. And my cats don't because they never learned how. Because they were separated from their mother at such an early age and put into a little cage all by themselves, the poor little kittens, all by themselves. And they had nothing to learn from. So they never learned to meow. So now I have basically mute cats. Well, except for the one that just kind of squeaks. I don't know how that one cat learned how to meow, but the other two cats don't meow. Innate knowledge. I mean, this is your most magical something from nothing theory, right? It was there all the time. Descartes, innate knowledge that we exist, innate knowledge that God exists. God, said Descartes, must have put a stamp or a seal in our brain, kind of like the mark of the maker. Very handy. Jung, with his theory of archetypes that are carried down through generations, which is how we get the wheel and all of that. Chomsky of language, a guy called Jerry Fodor, who's still alive. So is Chomsky too, isn't he? The other two are dead. Fodor takes Chomsky's argument to its logical conclusion and says, well, if language is innate, so is everything. Everything to do with language. All of our words, all of our vocabulary, all of our concepts. Famous book called The Language of Thought by Fodor, where he expresses this idea to the fullest extent. And I'm sort of sitting there reading Fodor thinking, yeah, computer keyboards. They had that idea in Neanderthal times, they just didn't use it. And it just doesn't make sense to me. If language was always innate, why was there a time when we did not use language? And the argument on him, all of these people use this, some version of this argument or another, is that it must be innate because everyone does it. Everyone learns language, says Chomsky, except for the exceptions. But, you know, there's always a way to do except for the exceptions. In philosophy, they have this phrase, ceteris paribus, all other things being equal. This is a great cop-out. Everybody has the concept of the wheel. Everyone has the concept of the self. Everyone has, says Descartes, the concept of God. That can't be an accident. But we're looking at justification here. Universality does not entail innateness. Universality entails, well, pretty well nothing except universality. Just because everybody thinks it's true does not mean we have that idea built into our head. And we come back to the concept of the circle. Everyone has the concept of the circle, right? But everyone lives under the sun. And the sun is a circle. So very clearly we could have an idea from an external source such that everyone has it. So innateness doesn't do it for me. And I'm just touching lightly on this argument, but it really doesn't do the job. All right. Another hyperspace link here. Because we do know things, right? Or at least we believe them. And we believe them despite the fact that we have utterly no reason to. really, when we look at it, in language, in logic. There's no reason for us to believe things. Why do we believe the billiard ball will go into the pocket? Particularly, at least in my case, given a horrible experience of frustration in which the billiard ball does not actually fall into the pocket. It goes somewhere else. Sometimes it doesn't even stay on the table. I'm not very good at pool. Cause and effect are not logically connected. The floor will not logically stay there. But as the slide says, and you've already read, it's the sort of thing we cannot bear not believing. This is a really important concept. I think it's a turning point in philosophy. It's not simply that, oh, well, I just have to assume that the floor will always be there. It's that I cannot bring myself in a real important sense to think that the floor is going to disappear. As Wittgenstein said, the proof that somebody thinks that the ice will hold him is the fact that he walks on the ice. The proof that I think the floor will support me is the fact that I walk on the floor. The proof that I know how to speak is the fact that I use language. All of these things, right? The proof that I know that I exist is the fact that I refer to myself. I cannot go through life. I don't know how to go through life. I couldn't bear to go through life without a concept of the self. Very important concept. So important that Kant, Immanuel Kant, said that these were necessary conditions for the possibility of perception. And the major ones that were, you know, space and time. Space and time are necessary for the possibility of perception. And then he tacked on God later, but space and time were the biggies. Philosophy is weird in that way through history. Well, okay, there's something to this. What if knowledge isn't propositional at all? Now, a proposition, what I mean by a proposition is a statement, or if you will, an expression, a string of words, to the effect that something is true. So, for example, the floor will support me. That sentence is a proposition. It expresses a fact and implies that that fact is true. What if knowledge wasn't like that? We think of knowledge, we have this idea that knowledge is kind of like sentences in the brain. I mean, where do you think Chomsky came up with the language of thought? And Fodor came up with the language of thought idea. We have this idea that language is like sentences in the brain. You get all the sentences right, like a big encyclopedia, we know. I grew up, there was a character I used to read about called Encyclopedia Brown. He was like that. Anytime you needed to know something, he had a sentence for you. What if that's not it? What if my knowledge that I exist is not, in fact, the sentence, I exist, in the brain? What if even factual knowledge, sentences like Paris is the capital of France, is more like a skill, like knowing how to throw a dart. Knowing how to ride a bicycle. How does that realize itself? How does that instantiate itself? Knowing, as I suggested on the first slide, according to this view, and you can tell by the plugging that I'm giving it, it is my view, is not the having of a fact at all, but a mental state, and nothing over and above a mental state. Knowledge, having knowledge, is like having gray hair, is like having blue eyes, is like having arms in this position. No more and no less than that. And when you think about it, you know, you cut open a person's head, you don't see sentences, you see mush, because you just cut open his head. What else could it be? This is the sort of thinking, not quite this thinking, but the sort of thinking that led people like Gilbert Ryle and others to advance a theory called behaviorism. And remember I said, you know, the logical positivism is what all of our administrators and political leaders believe today. Behaviorism is the other side of that. And you've seen behaviorism a lot in education. And it's still out there. there's a the International Standards Organization. I sort of peripherally am involved with that by virtue of sitting on something called Subcommittee 36 of the Standards Council of Canada. And their website's a mess. And so they have these definitions, right? They have the standard things, and the standard, according to ISO, learning is changing behavior. That's what learning is. That's their definition. Of course it's wrong. But there's a point to it. And the point is, on the Cartesian theory, because of course when you look in the brain, there is nothing but mind, but then there's all this magical knowledge type stuff. And it's not physical, obviously, so it must be mental. And so you have this mental stuff and this physical stuff. And what Ryle is saying to justify behaviorism, and the argument is much more important than the conclusion, is that Descartes' ghost in the machine is what he calls a category error. That's a really important concept for me. What does he mean by that? Well, suppose you went to a university campus, and of course, this is Ryle's example. He's writing in the American or the British context, so it's kind of like, you know, you go to the university and, you know, there's all this rah-rah spirit, right? And he goes around and he looks around the university, he pokes his head in the science building, pokes his head in the dorm. I can't find school spirit anywhere. I've looked everywhere. It's just not there. But the presumption that there is an entity, an existing thing called the school spirit, is a category error. A school spirit isn't the same kind of thing as a residence or a science building or a student or a teacher. It's something that, as we now say, emerges from that. You can take that even further. You know, poor Ryle, he gave up on looking for school spirit. That's fine. I want to find the university. If I can find the university, I'll be there. So he walks around, he finds a science building, he finds a residence, he finds an administration office, but you just can't find a building called university. And he's sort of sitting there, oh, I can't even find the university. But again, it's a category error, right? The university isn't a thing like the science building or the residence building. It's the combination of all of these things. And so in the same way, Descartes' ghost in the machine, Descartes' assumption that there is some sort of mental substance, to use Descartes' own words, is a category error. That the mental isn't the same as the, you know, what we're calling the mental isn't the same as what we're calling the physical. It's a different kind of thing. Well, what kind of thing? Well, Ryle's a good logical positivist. And as a good logical positivist, there's nothing but experience and inference. And it's not something in experience, so it must be something in inference. And so he advances the concept that knowledge, and indeed the self, if you want to take it that far, is what you call a disposition. It's not something that exists. It's not something that you can observe, but it's a property you can ascribe to something, even though that property is never instantiated. And the classic example is brakeless trains are dangerous. And if you think about that, there are no trains without brakes, right? But it's true, nonetheless, that brakeless trains are dangerous. And the reason why it's true is that if we had a train without brakes, then it would be dangerous. So a train without brakes would have what they call a disposition. It's a way it would act under circumstances, even though those circumstances never come into actual existence. Does that make sense? Okay, and there's a whole raft of literature under the heading of what is now called counterfactuals. The most important work in counterfactuals was written by a guy called Richard Stallnacher, and an Australian philosopher, a guy called David K. Lewis, has made a career out of this. And on the Stallnacher-Lewis picture, counterfactuals obtain their truth by virtue of being true in possible worlds. A possible world is just like this world, except we've changed one thing. That's what makes it the counterfactual, right? And in the possible world, there really are trains without brakes. And if you go to that possible world on Trans-Possible World Airlines, you're there, and everybody's telling you, watch out for the brakeless trains, they're dangerous. And David, something from nothing, right? David Lewis says, possible worlds really exist. That they are actually out there. That they exist as much as our world exists. And that there is a world out there, just as real as ours, that has trains with no brakes. And he's sort of sitting there and he's saying, why? Why would they do this? Obviously, I don't go that far. But there is a sense in which Ryle is right here. And the sense is that knowledge, mind for that matter, isn't the physical thing. That doesn't mean it's a mental substance in the religious Cartesian kind of sense. It's more like, it's like a disposition. More like. I'm fudging on that because I don't really believe the Ryle version of it, but I believe a different version of it, which I'm about to talk about. How's this going so far? I just want to check. Okay, you're all being very quiet, so that means either you're too dismayed to speak, you're too... Okay. All right. Let's leave Ryle for a moment, but keep brakeless trains in mind, because they're dangerous. Say another thing I didn't know when I came here. I guess the train goes right by. I'll tell you, I went to the Perth train station, and I went in and I asked them, do you have a map that tells me where the trains run? And the guy said, no. As though that was the most ordinary thing in the world. So I have no idea. So I took the line that said Fremantle, and the wild assumption that the line that said Fremantle actually went to Fremantle, but I did not have any sense of exactly where it was I was going. So I'm on this train. I'm going somewhere. It's been an interesting experience. We have buildings without signs, trains without maps. Context. Pardon?
You have innate knowledge in Perth,
you don't need to put up signs. You have innate knowledge, yeah. That's okay. I mean, it's not uniquely Perth. In Moncton, they have a newspaper, and, you know, events happen in Moncton, you know, coming events. So they're advertised in the Moncton newspaper, and the Moncton newspaper says, you know, don't forget to come down for the spring festival. Same location as last year. Well, I just moved there. So, yeah, it's not just Perth. Behaviorism is counterintuitive. Now, the philosophy, I missed that in my talk about behaviorism, but the philosophy of behaviorism, right, is knowledge is changed behavior, right? But, of course, that's not the case, because we know there's something between, like, you know, brain and arm, you know, like, my moving the arm just isn't my moving the arm. There's something happened in here. And so behaviorism misses that. The classic expression of the knowing is behavior philosophy is what's called the Turing test. The Turing test was proposed by a guy called Alan Turing. I don't know if you've, how many of you have heard of Alan Turing? A few? Good. Turing's very important. You know everything I'm talking about so far, don't you? I'm just sort of sitting here. When am I going to say something that surprises him? last tour of his life. Turing was a very important computer scientist. He's the guy who cracked the German code during World War II. Enigma was him. He's also a very important mathematician, computer scientist. Turned out also he was gay, and so he was hounded to his death at an early age, naturally. But Turing came up with a test of artificial intelligence. And the test was very simply, a machine can be considered artificially intelligent if, and only if, it can fool a human a person talking to it. I was going to say another word, but I can't think of how to pronounce it. Interlocutor. You know, I have never said that word. Inter what again?
Interlocutor.
Never in my entire, I'm 45 years old, I've never said that word. I've read it dozens, hundreds of times, never said it. Isn't that odd? Anyhow. Speaker. Well, but it's not just a speaker, right? It's a person having a conversation with the computer. And if the computer can fool the person into thinking that the computer is a person, it passes the Turing test. Well, there are lots of example counter arguments to that. Just a couple important ones. The Chinese Room one is the most famous example. It's by a guy named John Searle. And the Chinese Room is, suppose you had, at the one end, it's kind of like Chinese restaurant, Chinese Room, right? You put in your orders, you get your response back, right? So people write Chinese characters on a card, they pass it through this little slot in the wall. On the other side of the little slot in the wall, there's a person. Gets the little thing, right? Gets it, now he's got the characters in Chinese. Now this person's an English speaker, doesn't know a word of Chinese. Right? But it's got Chinese dictionary, a whole pile of little cards, right? And so he's able to use the dictionary, use the little cards, right? And he pulls out the right card. He's got a big rule book, right? Pulls out the right card, hands it back out. And the response is always appropriate. And by hypothesis, the response is always appropriate. Suppose the rules he had were good enough. Suppose the dictionary he had was good enough. So that this guy is so good, he fools all the people at the other side into thinking that he's a real person. Of course, he is a real person. But the question is, does he understand Chinese? And of course he doesn't, by hypothesis. His responses can always be appropriate, and yet he doesn't understand Chinese. And this is the thing with behaviorism, right? You can have all your responses in, you can get all your responses right, and still not know. In fact, where was it? Oh, it was the talk Gatto gave at the Australian, or it might be Gatto, I'm terrible with names, the day before mine at the Australian College of Educators, saying, you know, you have these people who study for their standards tests, and they cram, they get all this knowledge pumped into their head, and they go in and they do the behavior, right? They ace the test. Ask them 3 weeks later, none of it's there. All the knowledge is gone. They behaved appropriately, yet they did not know. And ironically, the people who do seem to know, according to the same speaker, are the people who did not, in fact, go to school or dropped out early. So I wanted to start off my talk the next day with, I am a dropout, but I didn't do that. Somewhere else I wanted to go. More interesting is Thomas Nagel's What Is It Like to Be a Bat? That's actually the name of an article. And the premise is very simple. It must be, in a certain important sense, different to be a bat than it is to be a human. And even if humans acted and behaved in exactly the same way, think of Batman, right? Except more like a bat. Or even think of vampires, right? The actual existence of being a bat must be fundamentally different than the existence of being a human. Because a bat has a sensation that we don't. Bat has radar. Right? Now, what's it like to have radar? It'd be really cool. Really, in a fundamental sense, I can't know. I can act as though I had radar. I can even have little pinging things in my ears, but it wouldn't be having the sensation of radar, would it? So there must be something to being a bat that is over and above behaving like a bat, says Nagel. And I agree. There's a certain sense, isn't there, in which the sense of knowing is ineliminable. That knowing isn't just having the facts, it isn't just being justified, it's having the sense. And we come back to the Hume thing, right? We come back to, I cannot bear to not believe that this floor will support me. is the sense thing. It's, as Hume would call it, a passion. The presumption. Now, you see, I'm still doing hypertext, but you're beginning to see the circles come together, right? The presumption behind the innateness theories. The Cartesian I exist. The Chomsky, there is a mental language, is that knowledge is propositional. Knowledge is like sentence. Knowledge is made up of facts. And facts are the things we can enumerate. But the contrasting view, the view that I am advocating here, the view that I am quite sure to a large degree of confidence is the case, is that knowledge is not like a set of sentences. It is rather more like habit. Hume says custom and habit. Other people would say a way of life. Wittgenstein, for example, might say a way of life. It's the stuff I cannot bring myself to stop believing. It's the habits, the customs and habits that have become so familiar and so well worn in my life that I can't imagine not thinking that these are the case. That's what knowledge is. And it's a fuzzy concept. But we're in a non-propositional world here now. It's going to be fuzzy. You get nice, crisp, clear concepts if you write them down. But unfortunately, if you write them down and get a nice, crisp, clear concept, you've abstracted out of reality. And in fact, that's what language does. People talk about language as being natural, language as being, you know, the way we think. Language is the most artificial thing that we have in our lives. Language is, in fact, the artifact. Language is not one, but probably several layers removed from experience. The word table in no way resembles a table. It doesn't behave like a table. It doesn't evoke all that a table has. The word table is an abstraction, a sign intended to represent or stand for or refer to, I'm being very vague there, the table. The key turn is this, and I owe a lot of this to Wittgenstein. Ludwig Wittgenstein, very famous Austrian philosopher, began in the logical positivist tradition, wrote a book called The Tractatus while he was imprisoned in an Italian jail during World War I, then had a change of heart and wrote some really important books such as Philosophical Investigation. Well, he didn't really write books, and this is why I like Wittgenstein, because I don't write books either. Books are way too linear for me. You know, I start at page 1, you go to page 300, and in between there's an argument. I don't work that way. And Wittgenstein, what Wittgenstein did is he wrote his thoughts on little slips of paper or little cards. And each card, you know, it vary in length. It might be as short as like 20 words, as long as 100 words. You have all these little cards and he'd arrange them. And there never was for Wittgenstein a right and final arrangement. In fact, it was his former students who organized these things after. So his two big famous books, Philosophical Investigations and the one that was most influential on me called On Certainty, are just a whole series of these little things, which is why O.L. Daily looks like it does, because I'm much more comfortable with the 100 word essay than with the 1000 or the 3000 word essay. And the stuff in O.L. Daily doesn't have an order. It will never have an order. It's not meant to have an order. Each thing is a thing separate, a thought separate. And you don't think of them as, you know, I mean, they're chronologically ordered because, you know, they have to be produced in time. But that's the only reason. But conceptually, put them in a big pile. That's the way they belong. So for Wittgenstein, looking at this, the problem of skepticism, Hume's skepticism, Cartesian skepticism, the problem of justification of knowledge isn't a problem of justification, it's a problem of language. We get confused, he said, by our language. And we play these language games, and so on and so forth. And Wittgenstein's approach, and here I'm not quite happy with this, but it'll do, is if we just simply made ourselves clear, then the problem of skepticism, the problem of justification, wouldn't be solved. It would vanish. It was never a problem in the first place. Well, something from nothing again, right? I don't really buy that. But I do buy this. The problem is language. Skepticism arises out of language because the possibilities created by an abstract framework of language far exceed the possibilities inherent in earth and in experience. Language gives us possible worlds. Language lets us say silly things like possible worlds are real. Language is what allows us to say, I might not be here talking right now. It's perfectly consistent in language, but totally violates experience. Experientially, there is no problem of skepticism. But in language, there is. So the problem is in language. And so I say, it's not simply that knowledge is like sensation. It's not simply that knowledge is based on or justified from sensation. I say, and here I'm following most closely Hume, knowledge is sensation. The two are one in the same thing. My knowing something is the same thing, the same mechanism, the same structure as my seeing the blue, I was going to say the red table, my seeing the blue table, my seeing the computer. That is the same as knowledge, structurally, right down to its roots. And the, I actually had to look at that to remember. And the kicker is, sensation itself is non-linguistic. We do not perceive the world in symbols. And I sort of sit here and say, of course not. I mean, the whole concept of an observation language was misconstrued to begin with. Of course we don't see in symbols. I look at that table, I'm not getting, you know, like one of those tickers, blue table, across the bottom of my sensation. You know, the whole thing, blue table, this table is blue. None of that's in my mind at all when I sense a blue table. And it's the same with knowledge. When I know that the capital of France is Paris, when I have that knowledge, it's not like I have a little ticker. Remember, the capital of Paris, the capital of France is Paris. I don't have that little ticker in my head. So, now we're moving toward a positive theory of what knowledge is and therefore of what learning is. How do we perceive? We perceive through our senses. But as I just said, we do not perceive a tree, say, as this is a tree. But we do not even perceive a tree as a tree. Not in the first instance, anyways. Now, of course, when I look at a tree, I'm like, oh yeah, a tree. But if we look at ourselves, we look at our mental processes, our recognition, that's a tree, is the result of a complex process, isn't it? What actually happens, and we know this because we have microscopes, we can look, is we have a barrage of sensations. However many neurons are in our eyes or whatever, we get a barrage of sensations from that tree, and over again, and the sensations are just coming in, and I can reach out and touch the tree, and when I touch the tree, a whole bunch of nerve endings fire off. I'm getting this barrage of information in. As I said, in Perth, which is just over there, on Saturday, a wall of sound and sensation comes at us, and we organize that. We pull the concept of a tree out of that mass of sensation. It comes, the knowledge, this is a tree, comes from, as I say, and here I'm glossing quite a bit, the pattern of input perception. In that mass of information that's coming to me, I'm able to recognize the pattern. And I recognize that pattern, and I actually assign it a name or a sign, which is tree. But my recognition that it is a tree does not entail my use of the sign tree. I could recognize a thing as a thing, even though I have no name for it. In fact, you know, I look at something, I've never seen that before. I have no name for that. I experience that a lot, actually. I go up taking pictures, and I take pictures of flowers, and I have no idea what that's called. It looks nice. And then Andrea later says, oh, that's a dragon flower. I go, what? Here's the picture of you. It's the one picture of my whole presentation. It's not that good, but gives you the idea. Sensation can be represented, it isn't actually, but can be represented as a grid of multiple simultaneous input or nerve activations. These inputs run through successive layers of neurons, and when you run things through successive layers of neurons, and we know this both experimentally and mathematically, you get patterns out the other side. Or as they call it, clustering, and hence recognition. I'm glossing. Oh, I lied. Here's another picture. I forgot. This is a structural representation of a neural network. And again, it's the same thing. Now, I want to be careful here, because, I mean, the term neural networks was kind of badly chosen. And it was badly chosen because the people who designed neural networks intended them to be emulations of neural processing in the brain. But when you actually look at neural networks and when you look at the brain, they're not really exactly the same at all. The neural network depicted here is a gross oversimplification of what's happening in the brain. But the name stuck. And the main thing I'm trying to get at here is something like this is happening in the brain. And the main thing I'm trying to get across here is that even if it's not exactly like this, even if it's segmented, even if there are different parts of the brain that do different things and so on and so forth, this is nonetheless manifestly not the same as thinking in sentences and words. It's very different. And what's really importantly different about it is that concepts in our mind are not located atomically in our mind as a word or as a sentence. And in fact, there's no particular place where the concept is at all. There's no particular thing in my mind that corresponds with the knowledge that Paris is the capital of France. Rather, this knowledge is, as they say, distributed. The knowledge exists in many places. I used an example in Tasmania again. I think it was there. The knowledge of how to build a 747. That's on my mind recently because I was on one on the way here, and I will be on one in a few days. And so I'm very much hoping that people do, in fact, know how to build 747s. Because when I stand there at the airport, I look at the 747, I say, there's no way. Yeah. They may say it's going to fly, but that's a big illusion. And really what happens is it gets to the end of the runway, it crashes, and all the people that were on the plane, they're replaced at the other end with new people. Because it can't fly. So it's the only logical theory, right? So I'm actually not the same person that was doing all that stuff in Canada. I've been replaced. Of course, I wouldn't say I've been replaced, would I? Anyhow, leave that aside. But the thing is, the point I was trying to make is nobody knows how to build a 747. Or more to the point, nobody knows how to build and fly a 747. If you think about that, it becomes clear and obvious that this is the case. How could this be? I mean, we see them flying. Well, no person knows how to build and fly a 747. Many people know little bits of it. Some people know how to make rivets. Other people know how to search for, find, and refine gasoline and aviation fuel. Other people understand navigation so that you don't fly into Toronto. Well, so that you do fly into Toronto. Duh. Other people understand metallurgy, metal stress factors. Other people understand aerodynamics. And if you put the knowledge of all of these people together and you pay them money so that they'll actually do stuff for you, you get a 747. There is no such thing as the place where the knowledge of a 747 is located. Is there? Could not be. Because it's too much for one person. In a similar way, the knowledge Paris is the capital of France is too much for a neuron. It's just beyond a neuron. Neurons can't handle stuff like that. Neurons can handle signal coming in. Ooh, change chemical state. Ooh, send signal out. Wing. That's about it for a neuron. I was sitting there thinking the other day, what's the mental state of a neuron? Of course, there is none. What is the mental state of a collection of neurons? That's like asking, where is the school spirit? What is the knowledge that Paris is the capital of France for a neuron? That's like asking, where is the university? The knowledge or concepts are distributed across large numbers of neurons in the same way that knowledge of how to build and fly a 747 is distributed across a large number of people. And in the when I say in the same way, I mean in the same way, in exactly the same way. The same pattern of networks, the same system of individual autonomous agents working in parallel with each other, sending signals connected back and forth. And that's why I get my views on copyright. If you think about it now. Because if you break down the connections with walls and fences and locked doors, you break down the knowledge of how to build a 747, you break down the knowledge of Paris as the capital of France. Copyright and patents are a brain malfunctioning. Order out of chaos. Something from nothing. The concept, how to fly a 747, Paris is the capital of France, as they say, emerges from the pattern of connectivity of the underlying entities. And this is something that we see every day when we watch the television. The television, if you look at a television, and I've done this, and probably everybody has done this at some point in their lives, you look really closely at a television, all you see are little dots. Well, maybe you haven't done it, but I've done it. Because I'm the kind of person who does that sort of thing. And the organization of the dots, and dots of different properties, obviously, but the organization of the dots is what produces for us the picture of Richard Nixon on the screen. You might ask, well, I always use the example of Richard Nixon because when I was very young, I used to make collages, and part of one of my collages was this really pixelated picture of Richard Nixon. So that, to me, is emergence in my mind. Emergence, the concept in my mind, is Richard Nixon on a television resigning. Association is a wonderful thing. Importantly, Richard Nixon is not in the pixels. Importantly, you could replace the set of pixels and still have a picture of Richard Nixon. And in fact, in a television, that's exactly what happens. The pixels are replaced several times each second. Completely new pixels. That's why we have to have a cathode ray tube, because the old pixels go away, we need new ones. That's how we get motion, we're just replacing the pixels. But the pixels aren't Richard Nixon. You could produce the pixels in a different medium. Ink, say. And produce a newspaper picture of Richard Nixon. It's the same picture, it's the same person, it's Richard Nixon. The idea is Richard Nixon, our recognition of this concept, emerges from the pattern of the underlying phenomenon. It's not caused by it, it's not created by it, it's not dependent on it. It is, in fact, a non-physical relation, isn't it? In fact, and what's key here is the only way Richard Nixon gets to be what emerges from those pixels is if there's somebody sitting there saying, oh, that's Richard Nixon. Right? And this is a point that a lot of people miss about emergence. Emergence requires a perceiver. Otherwise, you have chaos. Right? You need two things for an emergent phenomenon to have. You need the phenomenon, the pattern in the phenomenon, and you need someone somehow to recognize, oh, this is one of those. I cover that under the rubric or the heading of context. You don't get a pattern without a context. Oh. sorry. Sorry, there was a cognitive dissonance there. I just, it flows, but it doesn't flow. What I wanted to say as well about the 747, or the knowledge that Paris is the capital of France, is that this knowledge does not exist in isolation. Right? You cannot know how to fly, how to build and fly a 747 to, say, Toronto, unless you already have the concept of Toronto. Wouldn't make sense otherwise. In fact, you would have to have the concept of flying. You would have to have the concept of using numerical systems to represent airplanes, which really, when you think about it, doesn't make any sense at all. Right? That knowledge, in one sense, is distributed, as I've just described, but it is also inextricably meshed with all the other knowledge. And it's actually the same neurons pulling double duty. The same bits of knowledge in our head, one little bit of knowledge is on the one hand doing duty as, okay, this makes a 747 fly, and on the other hand doing duty as, okay, numbers represent airplanes. Just like a person who has the knowledge of how to build a 747 and fly it, or at least part of that knowledge, will also have the knowledge of how to make English tea biscuits. And that person is part of the collective knowledge of how to make English tea biscuits, as well as the collective knowledge of how to fly 747s. You see what I mean by that? So really, if you think about it, you have all the people. Think of that as a layer. And then one layer is, and you sort of tie it in, that's the knowledge of how to fly a 747. And another layer is, that's how to make tea biscuits. And so it's not simply that knowledge is distributed, it's also that knowledge is inextricably entangled in itself and entangled at a sub-symbolic, sub-propositional level. You cannot have the idea of how to fly an airplane to Toronto unless you have also the idea that Halloween falls on October 31st. They are propositionally completely unrelated, but they are, at least in some people, part of the same mental picture, the same melange, if you will. Which is why, now I can come to this slide, context is always important. And in fact, you don't get knowledge without context. Without context, without recognition, without placing things into perspective, knowledge itself is meaningless. No belief stands on its own. It's not that beliefs depend on other beliefs. It's that beliefs are quite literally part of other beliefs. And there's been a whole wave of philosophers in the latter half of the 20th century who have been by and large, well, I won't say by and large ignored, because they're not being ignored, but the knowledge of these people hasn't reached our leaders yet. Meaning changes according to context. I was just reading Michael Feldstein had a real nice blog post yesterday or today. His father's favorite gag is, they drive by a cemetery. Oh, everybody's dying to get in there. Right? Meaning is context. My father always used to say, right, same situation, different families. My father would drive by.
Oh.